on 1116 SEN. The Right Time with Gavin Krasiska, Nick Hall and Mark Fine.
Well, there you go, boys. I've got you dead and buried, and in the I've got you buried and in the ground.
Beautiful.
But we made it.
We'll all
meet our maker. May it be the manufacturer of the coffin we're buried in, if you don't have religious faith or a higher power.
Well, I might get there a year earlier, finally. Judging by your the years that you were saying there, if I'm in my 14th year, looks like I'm getting there quicker.
So you're in your 15th year.
15th.
I apologise. And you're in your Gavin.
Nearly fourth.
Yep, so we're...
Okay, all right, well, we can...
You can trade off.
It evens out.
Yeah, trade off.
But am I right in saying that for an addict in recovery, the war is not won until you leave this mortal coil and we say, you know, 57 years ago, Mick Hall knocked the last needle into his arm and took his last substance.
Yep.
And for the second part of his life... Here lieth a man who, you know, won for 57 years, and Gavin, 103 years later on, because he's bloody fit. But, you know, do you know what I'm saying? Because it's an ongoing battle, there's no, right, oh, thank God that's over.
Yeah, there's not really an end point to it. It's a continuum of care, and it's a process for us to live with every day, and we look after ourselves. And
we complete the program once they're patting us on the face with a shovel.
Yeah.
But... As daunting as that sounds, we all live like that anyhow. We all live vigilant of certain things in the world.
Yeah, it's a journey.
You know, this is...
You've got to live to get old.
Well, that's it. It's, you know, every day we will not cross against the lights, or not cross when a car's coming directly at us. We know what's going to happen.
Mm.
For an addict in recovery, there are cars to watch out for, and there might be beers, and there might be... lines of drugs, or there might be poker machines, but we all live cognizant of the fact we can't just blindly do whatever we want whenever we want, because some of these things go contrary to a long life. So
we have boundaries to keep us safe,
boundaries. Right. Your boundaries also, within those boundaries are certain behaviours and substances and
well, there's no cure. That's the thing. So so what happens is that our particular illness, we arrest on a daily basis, and we slowly get better and better and better, and it gets easier and easier and easier and all that sort of stuff. But there's no cure, you know. Like I've witnessed people with 20 years plus of complete sobriety and clean time relapse, and I'm telling you that within a matter of weeks.
Back to square one.
Unrecognisable. Mm. Unrecognisable.
Oh, so the old Marge Simpson kitchen door.
Yes, exactly right.
If people don't know that, it's a great piece of animation,
door,
but it's the swinging door. Marge has been working all day cleaning up the kitchen, and it's absolutely spotless. And Bart or Homer walks into the kitchen, and as the door swings open, you see the gleaming kitchen, and as it swings back shut, you catch a glimpse of the kitchen's in complete disarray as it was at the start of the day.
Correct.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah, you know, it is.
I've never seen that. But
all that hard work of Marge's undone by uncaring, you know...
In a millisecond.
Uncaring, unthinking Homer.
Well, that's, you know, and that's what we're sort of talking out the back there, you know, before we came on air, you know, and we're sort of, we just kind of said a little snippets with each other about coping skills, you know, and learning.
That's why they're so important, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, this is a continual, you know, there's pretty high stakes for someone that's an addict that's in sobriety, right? Like, it's a bit different if, I don't know, maybe for some other things, but for addiction, it's, the stakes are pretty high. So for Gavin or myself to slip up, and to relapse, I mean, the consequences are pretty severe, you know, and they could be fatal, you know. I mean, I hate to think at 14 and a bit years clean and sober, with everything that I've built up in my life, psychologically, emotionally, physically, financially, you know, relationship-wise.
Right.
You know, to pick up again, I mean...
All right, okay, pens and pads out, people. Let's get 10 coping skills, either proactive or reactive, to avoid relapse.
Mm.
Now, 9429 1116. So start thinking about things that either you or somebody you know has done who is in recovery from addiction, doesn't matter what the addiction is to, something that they would do. Now, proactively means before the fact, so to make sure that they don't fall back into bad habits.
So preventative?
Yeah, preventative. Yeah. And then reactive is when the thoughts are burning, like if, when you're 1 minute to midnight.
Yep.
You've got you. Found your old mobile phone, the SIM card. Thank God it survived the fire.
Yeah. Hey, that happens.
Or somehow you've got some phone, whatever it is, you are that close to, you've done it, you're about to ring up the phone, you know, you're about to get old Lou back on the phone or whatever his name was, and it's business.
Old Lou Reed.
Business as usual. They are the reactive coping skills, what you do at that point in time when the wheels are well and truly in motion. So we want 10 good ones.
All right.
And I reckon you've already come up with one.
Oh, jeez. Have I?
Well, what did you say about start? What did you say about not wanting, you know, business and fair, all the things that you would lose?
Yeah, that's right.
So consequential thinking.
Consequential thinking. Mm. So gratitude, you know, and that is one that I use as much as possible. There's a bit of a saying with a group of friends of mine and in the groups that we do that says, "Show me a grateful addict, I'll show you a sober and clean one."
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah,
right. And so remaining grateful and
for what you've got since to realise what has been achieved through recovery.
Oh, mate, what's at stake? So important.
What's at stake?
Well, that's exactly right.
So is there a way beyond thinking it? I'm not saying write it down on the wall or at the fridge door.
Consequential thinking is something that comes funny. So it's not something you get. Well, for me, it was not early days, but it grew. Yeah. And as I achieved healthy things, the need and the want for me to continue following that path increased. Yep. So therefore the consequential thinking increased as well. So gratitude obviously, but also knowing what I'm going to lose now is far outweighs the necessity for me, even when I get triggered or I have a thought that comes in about, you know, doing whatever. The consequential thing comes straight in for me.
That didn't hit me to start with.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have anything.
Yeah, fair enough.
So I had nothing to lose.
There you go. So I'll come to that in a minute. But with you, what you have to lose now is very similar to what you had to lose then.
Yes.
So how...
But I had...
How do you view it differently?
I had no knowledge or understanding of what was wrong with me. So I had all of this negative self-talk about me being the bad person and... incapable of being a father, incapable of being a loving husband, incapable of having ambitions and goals to work and so forth, taking away the drug or the drugs and alcohol has now allowed me to see
your place.
Basically acceptance around who I am and to be able to move forward.
So were you saying to yourself whilst you were doing drugs, were you rationalising that if it cost you your family and your job, they'd be better off without you anyhow?
For sure. Mm. For sure.
So that is... That is an enormous, that is the talk therapy and the countless hours spent in the company of people that have walked those steps to put you in the correct perspective. So that is really important, isn't it?
Absolutely.
That you value yourself and your place in your world, so you can't turn around and say, I've got a lot to lose, but all of them would be better off without me anyhow. Okay, so that's the difference, isn't it?
Yeah,
and it takes a lot of maintenance too, though, doesn't it, Gav? I mean, that stuff takes, you know, you might have that now, but you and I both know that there comes times where we can forget, you know. So we've got to make sure we do more than that. We've got to keep doing things that keep us reminded of that
and keeps building that.
All right, that's from the addict's perspective. We've got a lot of family and friends and concerned significant others of addicts listening.
Yep.
Do they need to reaffirm those facts to people? I mean, they've been through a hell of a lot. You know, they've been through hell to hell and back, some of these people, on the behaviours of the people that they love.
Yep.
Do they now need to, on a regular basis, tell these people how important they are?
Go on. Go for it, Gav.
I was going to say yes for sure. I think being positive in someone's recovery and their recovery activities is a huge benefit for them. Good. And again, I put in... Not in scales, but I think early days, it's when we speak to families, it's almost over the top, like you're speaking to a 7-year-old child.
Yeah.
That's a really good thing to do. A meeting would be great. Can I go to the meeting with you?
Yep.
Have you called your sponsor? And just sort of help them along the way.
That's great.
But as you get through that, you can sort of take a back seat a little bit, and then you can look after yourself more. As in, the family members can look after themselves more and not be so diligent or hypersensitive to what the addict's doing, and actually look after their own recovery.
And how about just if you are proud of somebody that has
nothing
fought this battle?
Nothing wrong with positive feedback, for sure.
Yeah, that's right.
As you would be proud of somebody who, you know, I'm constantly gobsmacked in awe of you two guys as to what,
thanks,
you
funny.
Know. The more I learn about addiction, the more I try to imagine the depths of despair that you're in and the guys you are now. So, you know,
it's absolutely amazing that we're here, Gav.
So
really.
But it doesn't embarrass me to do it. You know, maybe loved ones carry a bit of baggage from the past, and it's not that easy.
Well, they carry all those negative emotions, though, finally. So
I'm saying,
so getting into recovery, they're still, they've got the angers going up. And
now you're better, I can really hate you to your face.
Yeah, yeah. So
before I was worried if
afterwards.
I hated you, you'd do something bad. Now I can tell you what
you're
going
to die, you're
going to
hurt
us. Now that you're better,
So
that's not the time to do it.
No.
That can send people back to where they were. Interesting. Yeah. How about we take a break?
Yep.
Craig in Hoppers Crossing has a great coping skill when we come back. And on 4291116, you get where the conversation is going and how frank and revealing these two men are will give you an enormous insight into the dynamic of coping with the pressures that could see relapse. Like the right time. Like the right time. Welcome back to The Right Time. Good topic tonight. We didn't draw breath during the break, as we had more examples thereof. Gavin Krasiska is involved with Sober Living House, which is a residential facility. Is it both sexes, Gavin, or boys?
Yeah, look, we do have a girls' room, but girls are few and far between for us at the moment. We've had probably 1 month.
Is it a dangerous mix in a rehab facility to have boys and girls together?
It certainly can be, and we have quite strict guidelines in terms of I guess relationships and the way they communicate.
The boys' camp and the girls' camp had strict guidelines and fences, but people still snuck through gaps.
Yeah, and look, it's very common. Like, you know, when I was away for my first 28 days, there was stacks going on. And you take drugs and alcohol away from people, and the way
they get horny.
They get horny. But the way they become validated and get that feel good inside is by the opposite sex.
And even if you've got barriers that make it even impossible for fraternisation, the thoughts of such possibilities can
drive... floating,
I would imagine that can drive people on to... wanting to hook back into their stuff.
Yep.
Absolutely.
No,
it's
relationships in the first 12 months.
Yeah.
Full stop.
That's the advice.
Yeah, full stop.
Because they cause relapse continually.
But you're not a prison.
No.
No.
But I'm just saying, all of this is
I had that advice when I got clean and sober as well. When I put in the big effort, I waited 2 weeks.
Yeah, but that was in prison. And
how do you know, Finey?
And relationships there.
They're not really relationships.
Yeah. It's not really love, Mick. Let's go to Craig.
I don't know about that.
Let's go to Craig. A couple of
I'm confused.
Said that. Well, it's taken 3 years, but we finally broke through that bubble. Craig is in Hoppers Crossing. Good evening, Craig.
Good evening, guys. How are we going?
Hey, Craig.
Yeah, I suppose I'm a bit of background. I've had a bit of a drug addiction problem for quite a few years, and I'm about a month out of rehab, so back into the big bad world. And
beautiful.
Sort of daily practices I tend to use are sort of meditation. I get up and read the JFT every morning after I do my meditation.
That's the Just For Today book?
That's the one, mate, yeah.
Yeah. Good, daily readings in that one?
Yeah, just sort of gives you something to focus on for the day, and I've actually just come...
What was today's?
It was about family and detachment.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I read it with our boys this morning. You're right, it was about that family connection and
exactly what we're talking about tonight. Funny about that.
It was interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I was actually just come from the Werribee meeting, which is, there's only one meeting in Werribee a week, but that's the other things I do, you know. You've got to get to meetings and listen to other people's shares and realise that you're not alone, and you can everyone's doing the same, yeah, doing it for the same reasons. And I get a lot of strength from other people's shares, but just being in the rooms of NA. Yeah.
So. Tell me about your meditation, Craig. Like, what do you actually do to meditate?
I think guys at rehab are going to kill me if I don't get this right, but I think it's Wayne Dyer. We do the R meditation, which my daughter thinks is very funny at times, but it's just sort of, you know, you do sort of R's and then gives you positive affirmations, and you just go through that sort of stuff. And
I like it.
Can you give us an example there, Craig?
We're putting him under the pump.
I'm just wanting you to give us this.
I'm not going to give you.
You did quite well there, Gav.
Sorry, mate. Yeah, keep going.
I'm going to go for a bit longer than that, but to the guys at Bayside Rehab that I went to in Patterson Lakes, there, just give them a bit of a plug. But the rehab gave me the tools to sort of understand. You know, you get a lot of time by yourself, and just to understand the person you are, and my drug use stemmed from suppressing feelings, and I didn't think I had a problem for a lot of years, and until I got out of control recently, and luckily family and friends stuck by me and put me into rehab, and I'm slowly on the mend, sort of thing. So,
good stuff.
Great. Thanks for the heads up. Another coping skill. Now, when I hear, is it the Just for Today book?
Yep.
And the R's and self-affirmations, I see that obviously 12-step programs lend a lot on not one specific religion, but...
Spirituality.
So there seems to be a touch of monotheism in there, you know, with today's reading. And then the R's lend itself more to Eastern religions, like the chanting in Buddhism, for example. So whilst... And people say, have not accused, but have said of 12-step programs that there's an overlay of religious conversion attempted in there, but it's not, isn't it? It's about giving into a higher power that all
it of your own understanding, which could be
opens it right up.
It's perfect for me. I'm an agnostic, so I believe in a higher power, but I just don't really think it's the ones that are currently being.
Well, would suit you fine.
But even if it's an atheist, atheists believe that they are the controllers. You know, of their own, and that it works there as well.
It does work there, and the atheists are more, you know, just the absolute, you know, that believe that there is proof that God doesn't exist. You know, like there's just absolutely no possible way, and that's okay because it's not about God; it's about a higher power. It's about relying on
something
the fact.
Else.
About relying on the fact, and that something else can be a group. If I'm with 10 blokes that were horrendous addicts that are clean. And have been clean for 4 or 5 years, and I'm trying to get clean and sober. I mean, they've obviously got hold of something that I haven't got hold of. So they're my power that's greater than me. And so all I do is I try and follow what they've done to get that recovery. And if I do that, I've got a fair chance that I'm going to get the same thing that they got. That's basically the higher power at play there.
Yep.
And sometimes, you know, when we look at the steps and stuff like that, and they say, prayer and meditation and that sort of stuff, that's not necessarily praying to Jesus Christ or praying to any particular God. It's about trying to tap into, you know, like that can be just trying to think about what the group, what does, if you're involved in NA or AA, you know, those people that are in there, what are they saying to do, you know, what they say is the next step to do?
Prayer's an interesting one. Did you pray? Ever before?
Before
you became involved in the program?
Yes.
Please God, let me not die at this time?
My most sincere prayer was before I got clean and sober, and it was in prison.
Yeah.
When I got, my life was threatened, and I had to go and face the guy in the yard the next day, and I was pretty scared, and it was a very sincere prayer, and I asked to be given the courage to go and face whatever I had to face. And I did that. And it's amazing when you face your fears and you get that little bit of courage and you go and do what you got to do, how you can come out on top and...
Freeing.
Yeah.
So your prayer for me is an interesting one because it's... it's certainly not for me on my hands and knees and praying to God, but it's certainly I throw out little prayers continually without even realizing.
Yep.
It could be even, please light stay green for me.
Yeah,
because I need to get home because I don't go through amber lights anymore.
Yeah, you know
what I mean?
Yeah.
Like just even little things like that. It's just all a part of it. It's another way of connecting, I guess.
Look, the cultivation, right, and development of a relationship with some sort of higher power, it's pretty imperative.
Mm.
But it doesn't have to be based in any type of religion. I mean, I've never read a Bible, and I probably never will. I know hardly anything about religion, and I don't want to know, right? But I've had to tap into a higher power, and I'm telling you we're talking about coping mechanisms tonight. Well, that is my greatest coping mechanism because it's not reliant on you being available to answer my phone call. It's not being, reliant on me having a pen that works. It's nothing, it's something that I can tap into.
And it's a type of meditation in itself.
It is.
Just on another reactive or a coping skill that you would employ once you feel that you are tumbling headlong into reconnecting with your addictive behaviour. So either using again, drinking again, gambling again.
Yep.
So when you really are putting all the...
When you're on the edge.
When you are on the edge,
yep.
What is sort of a last-minute fail-safe that you could put in place? Is there such a thing? Is there a doomsday mechanism at the very end?
I reckon it's really difficult for people like us to get to that line, I guess, where it's almost no coming back. And I hear the boys talk about that had a relapse and so forth. And the first thing that we say to them to do is call someone. Call your sponsor. Call someone that you trust. Call one of us. It doesn't matter what time it is. Give us a buzz. But what we find is what they say is that it's the last thing they're going to do when they're actually in obsession and craving for the drug to make that phone call very, very hard.
What if they were committed to that phone call every day?
It makes it a lot easier.
If there's somebody in their life that at 8 o'clock at night, doesn't matter where they are in the world, they just say, "G'day, mate, it's me."
What's really encouraged in the program with your sponsor or an older cleaner member that you trust and so forth.
I do it 14 and a bit years down the track. I've got my best mate who's 32 years clean and sober. We do not go a day without speaking to each other.
It doesn't have to be a long chat,
I had an experience when I was about 10 years sober. Well, no, maybe a bit less, but about 8 years sober. I was working at Flagstaff Crisis Accommodation Centre. I was working with the homeless. Anyway, I was knocking off one day. It was about 40 degrees. I walked out the front of the centre. This was in West Melbourne. And there's this guy, this homeless guy, sitting in the gutter, and he had a goon bag, right? So he had a bladder of wine. And he had four stubbies of Vic Bitter sitting next to him. He was sitting in the gutter. He must have had his head punched in or something. His head was busted open. There was blood everywhere. Wow. Right? Just a typical scene round there.
Mm.
Anyway, he's necking this goon bag. And I walked out the front of work and I was walking home. Remember, 8 years sober. And I stopped dead in my tracks. I looked at him. And my God, I was just absolutely overcome with an urge to go and sit down next to this bloke and crack a can. You know, it was unbelievable.
Oh, wow. That's not what I thought you were going to say.
Mate.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I did what I'd been trained to do, right? I recoiled from it as from a hot flame. Whoa. Shit. What's going on here? Walked around the corner and went to the failsafe.
On the phone.
Rung up me mate, who's still my best mate today. And I didn't need him. So this is the power of doing this, right? I was 8 years sober, right? There was no words of wisdom that he could give me that were going to change anything, right? But the simple act of me picking up that phone and ringing him meant that I wanted to stay sober more than I wanted to go back to where I came from. And this disease, that craving, that whatever it is, lost half its power, you know, just by making that phone call.
Wow.
That gave me enough to go get the hell out of there. But you know what? I went to a meeting that night. I shared about it. Felt like everyone was going to go, oh, how could he be like that at 8 years sober and judge me? And I was just inundated with people that were 20, 30 years sober. Right?
That said,
I'm so glad that you talked about that because it's happened to me and I felt like a freak. And it's funny when we share these things, we're not alone. You know, and so the next day, I was back at work. I was emptying syringe bins and, dealing with people that were drunk and, all of that sort of stuff. And it wasn't a problem. And I didn't get another incident anywhere near that, but I certainly had other incidences since then. But it was a few years later before I really copped another one. So
that is a powerful story. We're talking about coping skills. Can I just ask a sidebar question?
Yeah.
When you say you had a nerve to sit down and crack a can with him,
yeah,
is that another way for somebody 8 years in recovery of saying, I had a real urge to go back and do the whole bloody lot again?
Absolutely.
It's not about sitting and having one can.
No, I want to
go back to that life. I'm going all the way back through the portal, right back to hell.
There's something really, really sick. And so when the disease of addiction grabs you, when you've had some time in sobriety, I liken it. It's like a black cloak just comes around and grabs around you, and it's just, you know that it's no good. It's evil, right? But you just can't resist it. It's hard to describe, but it's just, it's so bad, but it's very unnerving because you don't know whether you can resist it, and it's, and for someone like me, I know what's there. Like, I know that one teaspoon of alcohol or one drug and I end up back in prison. That's my history. I mean, that's the bare minimum that happens to me. So I know that is a consequence. But the thing with consequential thinking is that there comes a time in an addict's life where consequential thinking is of absolutely no help and cannot be sufficiently brought to the forefront of the mind to hold you in check. And that's where we need to have had lots and lots of repetition. And I call it building up the bank of sobriety. So over the years of my recovery, I've done many, many things on a continual, frequent basis that keep me spiritually, emotionally, and psychologically, depending on who you speak to, as well as I can be,
So just on that, so do you think, and like we go to regular meetings and so forth, and we see people, then all of a sudden you don't see someone for a couple of years or a few months.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden you see them come back and they've relapsed.
Yep.
Now, are you saying that that's a possible chance that these people have gone away and not been diligent with those coping tools and
Absolutely.
The exercises to continue
it's impossible
building
to.
That network and that, what did you call it,
Bank of Sobriety. Absolutely, yeah. Because what happens is the person leaves, and you know how we were talking about that higher power? So the higher power is the group of people that are all heading in the same direction, all at different lengths and whatever, but they're all heading in the same direction. And when we move away from that higher power, which for a lot of people is meetings and stuff like that, and other people that are on that pony, and we go back to our own thinking, right, and relying on our own thoughts and our own resources, that's what we call, okay, so we'll break it down, that's what we call self-will. So my will is my thinking and what I want, right? And so when I go back, which is neither good nor bad, but it's selfish, which is neither good nor bad. It's just my thinking and what I want.
And your thinking in the past, Mick, has got you where?
Well, it's got me in prison.
It strikes to the deepest essence of philosophy, of free will, of Rene Descartes, I think, therefore I am. These are my thoughts, and this is the person I am, are those thoughts. Is there a voice? I know you have your little itty shitty committee or whatever it's called.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. That's a good one. Yeah, good. You remember that.
I picked up on that.
Yeah, good one.
But is there a voice that said to you when you looked at that beer and that pitiful...
Well, hang on, which voice is he talking about? Because there was a voice.
No, I'm saying there is a voice that says, not just that I want a nice cold beer, but also I want to go back to that life. Is there a voice that says, come on, mate, you know what destiny had in place for you. This is, you had all those years thinking that's how it's going to end, that it was, I'm an addict and I'm going to die an addict. That it's a tiny voice can't be quelled that says, come on, mate, you know you were destined to, That's self-worth and whatever, but you know you're going to die, shit kicked out of you in a gutter or in a prison or something, and you haven't been able to completely quell that voice, even after 8 years, as was the case?
Yeah, well, that's the thing, Fonny. Yes. The answer to that question is yes, but it's not there all the time. So addiction, if you can imagine the gas heater, right? You know the gas heater has a pilot light?
Yep.
Yeah, that's addiction. And all you got to do is turn that knob up. Up she goes.
Yep.
Right? So arresting addiction, we can't ever put that pilot light out.
No.
But what we can do is we can turn the gas knob down to zero. Right? It just stays on pilot.
And
but
you
it's
can
always
keep it
there.
Down.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can keep it turned down. And that is the key to true recovery, is to keep that turned down. Now, unfortunately, you know, what some people realize is that they have a certain addiction and they get into recovery, and then unfortunately they realize that there are other behaviors and other addictions that can turn that knob up and kick that pilot light off again. You know, when that's when we start looking at people that are trying to maintain their recovery, and next thing you know, they're bloody, you know, like they've done everything on gambling.
Mm.
You know, or they're, you know, or there's other addictions that
and
happen,
behaviors
you know?
That are almost we see the lapse happening before our very eyes, and a week later it's happened.
That's right.
You know, we see it coming. It's like
you know the
well,
signs.
We can see the behaviors, and it's what Mick was saying about the behaviors. The behaviors and the signs where it just starts festering.
I'm saying we need to take a break.
But
I think that comes back to coping skills, maybe of others. To watch for the trigger. So when we come back, John in Box Hill, who's been enormously patient, hopefully has got a great deal out of listening, which he would have done anyhow, I imagine, will be our first caller. And then a coping skill, a different coping skill, and that is the expert eye that can see the imminent fall, and maybe how we teach more people in society to have that expert eye. Welcome back to The Right Time. We spoke of Gavin Krasiska's Sober Living House, but I didn't give you the number, 9578 1746. To get somebody you care about into that facility is sometimes not simply a matter of organising and paying the bills for a grateful addict, because often they don't want to go. So intervention is required, and alcohol and drug help, if you contacted them, would they be able to get through on that same number?
You get through on the same number, they're fine, yeah.
Take this number down, 9578 1746, can be the facilitator or aims to be the facilitator that helps get an addict, even an unwilling one, into a facility. Dayhab, we know, is Mick Hall's. It's born out of Mick Hall's life, two lives. His horrific life as an addict, his war against addiction, which is his recovery, and the warrior created Dayhab. And Dayhab was originally an outpatient facility, but it's not just that anymore.
It's not fine. It's a 28-day live-in program, and we also have a two-week outpatient program. Awesome program, very successful, and we stand ready to help a person that needs a solution to this problem.
Like any good businessman, I'm sure you'll say both, but which is the more effective, the 28-day in-house or the...
It's different horses for different courses, Finey. Some people really need that 28 days, and some people have a really supportive family and a good network outside of the rehab, so they're fine to come in and do the 2 weeks.
And that 2 weeks might be the only possible way of getting somebody in.
You need a whole range of different times and lengths and programs, and you know, there's a niche, there's a spot for most organisations, I can tell you.
Better to work with what you can work with
in
an addict than nothing at all?
Well, there's nothing watered down. Yeah. But let me tell you, there's nothing watered down in the two-week program, right? So everything they get in a two-week program, you're going to get in a live-in rehab, right? But in a very, it's very focused and it's jam-packed. So there's no sitting around twiddling thumbs, weaving cane baskets, talking crap, right? It's full-on. You know, absolutely full on. And like with the day program, the guys have to go home and they've got to take homework home and the stuff that they've got to do, the stuff that they need to achieve outside of hours as well. It's just that they're going back home to their environment, to their supportive family at night.
And we like to get them after that.
Yeah.
To
make cane baskets.
Yes, and provide that continuing part for them and allow them to be able to then sit with themselves a little bit. So we're not anywhere near as intense. But then that's about letting these feelings and emotions come up so that we can have a look at them.
The resources described here and others are all at a fingertip or a mouse click away on therighttime.com.au, the website that marries to this program. You go there and you can click and find more information about various facilities. John is in Box Hill. He has the patience of Job if he is still with us, and we thank you for sitting through and hopefully taking us to a great finish for the hour. How are you, John?
Yeah, I'm good. Yourself?
Very good, John.
Good. This is a funny one, but, you know, I've got a 9-year-old kid. Kids try drugs, all that sort of stuff. And you can see one of his particular mates is going downhill, and we can see it. He's grown up with him his whole life, and we know he's going downhill. Every time he comes around, you can tell he's on a downer. He's been locked down in his house about 8 weeks ago. He's still back on it. My son's, you know, really concerned. But how do you, as a parent, make contact with that parent and give them the, you know, it's pretty hard to ring up and say, hey, your son's doing ice, doing this, you need to do something. I'd be devastated if it was happening to my son and a parent couldn't feel like they could ring me and tell me this was happening to my son.
I guess, John, it's about how you approach it. You know, it's not about sort of whether or not you should do it. I mean, obviously you should. If you've got genuine concerns and you care about this kid, then, you know, I think that, you know, making a phone call or having a conversation with the kid's parents, but done in the right way, coming from the right approach, coming from a concerned, you know, not accusing, just, you know, in a supportive way, is the right way to go about it. And yes, those conversations are hard, but you know what? If none of us ever have the hard conversations, nothing changes. And if nothing changes, nothing changes, mate.
John, I think you answered your own question when you said you'd like to be informed if your child was taking ice or another substance that placed that child in danger. You'd like to be made aware by another parent. I think you've answered your own question. But the great advice there was not to be judgmental, not to ring up and say, your kid's bloody ruining my kid's life. If you don't stop it, I'm going to come over there and sort it out myself.
I think the key to that, though, you need to have factual events, though. Don't go in blazing your gun saying your kid's doing this and doing that.
Well, no, it has to be factual.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, you can also go and just say, look, I'm concerned. I'm just worried. I think something's not right.
Mm.
You know, you don't even have to get specific. You say, look, I think something's not right.
I'm not talking about photographic evidence, but if your son is good mates with somebody, and that's often the connection.
Yeah, that's right. And you can have a pretty fair idea,
aren't
they?
And they spend time together. You can share a concern.
Yeah.
You can say, I'm worried about our boys.
Both. Mm.
Yeah, exactly. Together, yeah.
Talk it through. I'm sure out there you're as logical as we are. Talk it through and talk maybe with a couple of other parents that are at arm's length and come up with a sensible approach. Because, as John said, he'd like to know if it was his son. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank
Gavin
you.
And Mick.